Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Suyapa Portillo, Assistant Professor of Transnational Studies at Pitzer College, who takes a critical look at the Trump administration response to thousands of Central American refugees seeking asylum at the U.S.-Mexico border. Professor of Economics Richard D. Wolfe, who assesses General Motors' just-announced layoffs and the role government could play in alleviating the economic pain that will be felt by some 14,000 workers who are slated to lose their jobs. And New Jersey climate activists, who recently ended a two-week water-only fast, discuss their demand that the state's governor, Phil Murphy, reject all new fossil fuel infrastructure projects. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A botched undercover raid by Israeli special forces in the Gaza Strip on November 11th led to several days of intense fighting between Hamas and the Israeli military that included Hamas militants firing more than 400 rockets inside southern Israel and Israeli forces bombing 160 targets in Gaza. An all-out war was averted by a ceasefire negotiated by Egypt. The fighting between Hamas and Israel was the most intense since the 50-day war in 2014. The ceasefire with Hamas was very unpopular with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's militant political base and nearly led to the fall of Netanyahu's right-wing government when his extremist defense minister, Avigdor Lieberman, resigned from the government in protest. After Lieberman and his party left the government, other nationalist parties also threatened to pull out. In the end, Netanyahu held on to a narrow majority. Israel's next election isn't scheduled until November 2019. Lieberman's demand for another massive Israeli military operation against Hamas in Gaza was rejected by the Israeli military, which has made clear the futility of a purely military response. The Israeli security forces were reportedly unanimous in recommending the truce with Hamas. Since March, more than 150 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli fire, most in mass demonstrations at the border organized by Hamas to protest Israel's economic blockade of the overcrowded coastal strip. The recent Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, or APEC, forum held in Papua New Guinea and attended by both Vice President Mike Pence and Chinese leader Xi Jinping was the first such summit meeting since 1989 to fail to issue a joint declaration. Analysts say this failure, caused by disagreements over trade between Beijing and Donald Trump, signals rising tensions between the two nations, with China demonstrating its willingness to cast diplomacy aside in favor of a more aggressive posture as it challenges U.S. dominance in the region. At the same time that China is moving to assert its economic and military influence in the Pacific region, President Xi has come under criticism for dismantling many economic reforms that paved the way for China's remarkable growth over the last 40 years. Xi Jinping's opponents say that under the guise of fighting corruption, he is building a cult of personality, concentrating more power in his hands than any Chinese leader since Mao Zedong. While some critics concede that Xi's efforts may make China appear less corrupt and more stable in the short run, they say he risks being unable to navigate a serious destabilizing future economic crisis, which would likely send shockwaves through the entire world economy. Since the Great Black Migration of the 1940s, Oakland emerged as a center of black culture and politics in California. Once called the Harlem of the West, it was the center of the jazz and blues music scene in the 1950s and was the birthplace of the Black Panther Party in the 1960s. However, after decades of bank redlining, the bulldozing of black neighborhoods, and a city police force that systematically targeted its black citizens, the biggest threat facing Oakland's working-class black families is the extreme housing crisis plaguing the Bay Area. Pressured by the nation's highest-priced real estate in neighboring San Francisco and Silicon Valley, Oakland is now experiencing some of the most rapidly rising rents in the U.S. While black residents made up nearly half of Oakland's population in 1980, that number dropped to 28% by 2010. The Guardian newspaper reports that if current trends continue, African Americans in Oakland could comprise just 16% of the population over the next decade. In the November 6th midterm election, activists with the Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment campaigned against gentrification and for strengthening tenants' rights. While they succeeded in passing Measure Y, a countywide initiative that will expand Oakland's just cause protections against unjustified evictions, they lost a statewide vote on Proposition 10 that would have allowed cities like Oakland to pass their own rent control laws. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
As a caravan of thousands of Central American refugees fleeing violence and repression in their homelands walked through Mexico toward the U.S. border to seek asylum, President Trump used his bully pulpit in the closing days of the U.S. midterm election campaign to label these immigrants, comprised mostly of women and children, as invaders posing a dire threat to the nation. To underscore his false narrative, Trump ordered thousands of American troops deployed to the U.S.-Mexico border. Some 5,000 refugees from the caravan recently arrived at the border between San Ysidro, California, and Tijuana, Mexico. After U.S. border officials greatly limited the number of asylum applicants allowed to make their legally authorized claims each day, several hundred frustrated men, women, and children organized a peaceful protest on Sunday, November 25th. Later, some broke away from the protest and pushed up against a border fence or attempted to climb it. In response, U.S. agents fired tear gas into the crowd, and the gas drifted, affecting families with children, including many who were far from the clash at the border fence. Your reporter spoke with Suyapa Portillo, assistant professor of Chicana Latino Transnational Studies at Pitzer College, who takes a critical look at the Trump administration's response to the thousands of Central American refugees seeking asylum in the U.S., and the urgent need for comprehensive immigration reform.
This situation opens up a whole lot of different things. On the one hand, there's questions of sovereignty. There's U.S. Military at the border. There's riot police. There's border patrol firing into Mexican territory, right? Are they allowed to do this or not? And then why is the Mexican government sort of sitting back and allowing this to happen? Those are really key questions about sort of Trump's narrative here. If people don't do what he says, he's going to cut their aid. So if, like, Mexican government doesn't do what he says or the Central Americans don't do what he says, he's going to cut their aid, which is something that is not up to him, but rather up to Congress, right? But the narrative is so problematic that you see sort of, you know, like Enrique Peña Nieto has had all month to engage with this caravan or to do something about it. But because he's on his way out and on December 1st, the new president of Mexico will be sworn in, and that's AMLO or López Obrador. And that's going to be the key issue for his presidency, right? So the old president is leaving it up to him and not doing anything about this. So Mexico's had about a month to engage with this caravan, but has left it to this, right? And really putting people in danger, because when you're confronting a military, a National Guard, and a Border Patrol agents who are sort of pretty happy about gassing women and children, you know, you are putting people in danger.
Professor Portillo, do you believe that the White House has created a pressure situation there, keeping these immigrants who are seeking merely an application for asylum, keeping them there in Mexico en masse, as a way to ratchet up the tension and possibly provoke people to act out in ways that would affirm Donald Trump's own assessment of these immigrants as somehow a dire threat to the nation?
You know, I've kind of come to the analysis that we're looking at Trump optics, right? Like, this is all about the appearance of generating chaos at the border. That, you know, that's why I think some of the images are really critical, because you see that, you know, these are women and children who are being gassed. These are young people who are being gassed, right? So in some ways, it's about optics for the Trump administration. The pressure situation has been something that has been generated over time. For example, looking back at the Obama administration support of the coup d'etat in Honduras in 2009, the Trump administration support of Juan Orlando Hernandez, you know, fraudulent elections in November 2017. So, you know, those are kind of the pressure points, you know, that are really forcing people to leave, you know, to get away from some of the political violence and the gang violence, as well as the violence generated by poor government, right, who can't handle, this president doesn't have a handle on what's going on in the country. So I think that the pressure situation is generated by the United States, whether it's with the Democratic presidency or this Republican presidency over time. And I think that Trump has been dying to mess with the border, to build the wall. I think it's all about showing his base. It's all about being a strong man, as if this were a poker game. But unfortunately, this is not a poker game. These are people's lives. These are children's lives who will forever be traumatized by the Trump administration's separation policies or by some of the violence that they've witnessed at the border.
There's a new Democratic Party majority coming into the House of Representatives. There's been a very long stalemate between the House and Senate, Democrats and Republicans, in moving forward with comprehensive immigration reform legislation. And it seems now more than ever you have rising consciousness in this country that reform of our immigration policy is urgent. Do you have any hope that the Democrats in the House, who will be taking over that chamber in January, can do anything to move the cause of immigration reform forward?
You know, I think under the Trump administration, I don't think anything's going to happen. In fact, we're actually going back on accomplishments such as DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or Temporary Protected Status, all those programs that have been canceled, that have been really relief programs for people here in the United States. So if we can even sustain what already exists. But I also want to remind your listeners that during 8 years, the Obama administration and during Hillary Clinton's stint in the State Department, more people were deported. 3 million people were deported from the United States. That's the largest number of deportations in the history of the U.S.
That was Suyapa Portillo, assistant professor of Chicana Latina Transnational Studies at Pitzer College. For more perspectives on the Trump administration's response to Central American immigrants seeking asylum in the U.S., visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In an announcement that caught the nation by surprise, General Motors said on November 26th that the company will lay off up to 14,000 workers in North America and close 5 auto manufacturing plants. Factories slated to be closed by the end of 2019 include the Lordstown Assembly Plant in Ohio, the Detroit Hamtramck Assembly Plant in Michigan, the Oshawa Assembly Plant in Ontario, Canada, the Baltimore Operations Plant in Maryland, and the Warren Transmission Operations Plant in Southeast Michigan. The GM layoff announcement comes before a predicted downturn in the economy, with additional layoffs expected soon from automakers Ford and Toyota. GM and other car manufacturers say that with changes in consumer demand, they're reducing their production of sedans and increasing the number of SUVs and trucks they make in North America. The GM layoffs come less than a year after Congress granted the auto industry major tax cuts, and 9 years after GM received a $50 billion taxpayer bailout during the Great Recession. Your reporter spoke with Richard D. Wolf, professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, who's currently a visiting professor in the graduate program in international affairs at the New School University in New York City. Here, Professor Wolf discusses GM's layoffs and the role government could play in alleviating the economic pain that will be felt by hundreds of thousands who will be impacted by the massive job loss.
Let's remember that this is only an announcement by one major automobile company, General Motors. We will await in the next days and weeks what other challenged car companies are doing, both American companies like Ford, but also foreign companies that have plants here in the United States. So it may be that this announcement, horrible as it is, basically saying that General Motors is cutting roughly 15,000 jobs in the United States and Canada. And considering this season, this is an amazing choice of date to do this. It's like a Christmas present of the horror kind for these people. But of course, it's not only for those people, because if these cutbacks go through, as I expect they will, they're the end of the Chevy Impala, the end of brands of the Buicks and so forth. This means other people who used to have jobs producing the parts for these cars, they will not have jobs either. The ramifications and the ripples will hurt literally hundreds of thousands of people before this is over. That's the first thing. The second thing is, these automobile companies were on the verge of bankruptcy, certainly GM was, a bare 10 years ago. And they turned to the American people through the government for a bailout, which they got. General Motors alone got $50 billion, an unheard of amount of direct subsidies to a manufacturer in the United States, probably the biggest one in history, at least until that time. Eventually, the company paid it back, but not all of it. It paid it back short $10 billion, nor did it pay interest for all the time that it had the people's money with which to keep itself going. And it took all kinds of steps then, under the protection of the government, to allow itself to hire workers at lower pay, to get rid of their health program for retired workers, things that they justified, even though that hurt lots of people, on the grounds that now, with all of this support and the billions of taxpayer money, they would be able to assure a good future for what was left of the automobile industry. And here we are, a bare 10 years later, and once again, they are telling us they are at death's door, that they have no choice, what they always say, and they're repaying the kindness of the American people to bail them out by slashing, as I say, 15,000 jobs, with the ramifications coming and making God knows what trouble. But here is the final point, and maybe the biggest one. These steps are taken to assure the profitability of General Motors. To read the statements they released, they're telling stories about how Americans don't want to buy sedans anymore, and they're simply having to adjust to not produce what the public doesn't want, and they have to invest in electric vehicles, they have to invest in self-driving vehicles. Well, come on. This has been known to be a problem for at least a year or two already. They didn't take the steps to prepare themselves for this transition. They are now deciding that what's good for the profits of General Motors is to throw 15,000 people and Lord knows how many communities and families and feeder jobs under the bus. And we should have no illusion. Masses of people will suffer so that the relatively small number of people with a significant ownership of shares in General Motors will do better. We know in America that the richest 10% of our people own 80% of the shares of companies. To do something that hurts working people in order to provide greater profits to the share owners has to be rewritten for what it is. It's hurting the majority to profit a minority that is already rich. And that is a system that this country has long been overdue to question and to replace. And I think this General Motors thing only makes that more obvious and more urgent.
That was Richard D. Wolff, visiting professor in the graduate program in international affairs at New School University in New York City. He's author of the book, Capitalism's Crisis Deepens, Essays on the Global Economic Meltdown, 2010 to 2014. Find more analysis and commentary on the General Motors layoff by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In light of the most recent United Nations report from climate scientists indicating that the world has between 12 and 34 years to completely turn away from fossil fuels or face cataclysmic climate disaster, concerned groups and individuals have been ramping up climate protests and other actions. One recent event was a 14-day water-only fast in front of the state office building in Trenton, New Jersey, calling on Democratic Governor Phil Murphy to reject any new fossil fuel infrastructure projects in the state, including pipelines, compressor stations, and power plants. The governor has taken steps to increase the state's production of renewable energy and has brought New Jersey back into the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, a cap-and-trade system that places a price on carbon that generates investments in clean energy and energy efficiency. But those who fasted say these efforts are being undermined by the state's continued reliance on fracked gas. Two men fasted the full 14 days, while many others joined in solidarity for shorter periods. The fasting climate activists succeeded in getting the attention of top state officials, who pledged to hold a meeting with them after the Thanksgiving holiday to discuss their concerns. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was in Trenton for the closing ceremony of the fast and brings us these excerpts of comments made. We hear first from Matt Smith, an organizer with Food and Water Watch New Jersey, who began the ceremony.
Today is the closing ceremony. We're here with folks who have been sacrificing food now on their 14th day to lend urgency and to dramatize the need for bold and immediate action on climate change here in New Jersey, and specifically to stop the proposed 12 new pipelines and power plants and compressor stations and other long-term fossil fuel projects that seek to push us over the climate cliff. I first connected with Chief Perry and other members of the Ramapo Nation back when the fossil fuel industry began targeting the Ramapo's lands up in so-called Mahwah, New Jersey, and the Ramapo Mountains to build this explosion, this proliferation of infrastructure, of pipelines to continue the expansion of fracking and fossil fuels and climate destruction. First with the Tennessee Gas Pipeline, which is now owned by Kinder Morgan, which transports fracked gas from Pennsylvania into New Jersey in the Northeast. And again later with the Pilgrim Pipelines, which was a proposal to build two new oil pipelines from the Port of Albany, New York, down to the Bayway Refinery here in Linden, New Jersey. And that was to carry and transport fracked oil from the Bakken Shale.
Chief Dwayne Perry of the Ramapo Lenape Nation said a prayer.
Today is truly Thanksgiving because we come here collectively. We come here with one heart, one mind. We come here to both lift up, pray, and to hold the earth. And to me, that is truly Thanksgiving, and perhaps going forward, Thanksgiving will be a day like today where we're giving of our spirits to walk forward as one to save this earth.
Reverend Robin Tanner from the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of the Beacon Summit Church is here to say a few words. So thank you and welcome, Robin.
So I come from a faith tradition, Unitarian Universalism, that is really multi-faith in its core. And what guides us and holds us together are seven principles. And we like to say that the most important are the first and the seventh. The first being that we are called to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. The seventh being that we are called to affirm the interdependent web of existence of which we are all a part. And it is in living in the tension between those two principles that we seek to be first and foremost in right relationship with the earth, in right relationship with one another, and that's how we are called to live out our faith. The decimation of First Peoples in this country, the absolute ecological devastation that we find ourselves in, and the machinations of the machines of injustice that promote things like voting rights suppression. And whenever we see people's rights being trampled upon, their lives being denied, that these are all interrelated and interwoven. And that in this machine of injustice, a machine that is largely fueled through white supremacy, you cannot tie one injustice away from another. And so to be in right relationship calls us to certain practices. It calls us to a practice of humility and of putting ourselves back in a rightful place in that web rather than putting humans at the center of existence and creation. Fasting is an ancient practice of developing that recentering of human existence. Humans across cultures and across generations have fasted as a way to be back in right relationship, as a way to center themselves spiritually and to remember what is most important.
A Ramapo Lenape man who goes by the name of Owl, who was one of the two people who fasted the full 14 days on water only, concluded the ceremony.
In a certain level, that we all are fossil fuel addicts, that we all, you know, have an addiction we have to deal with. And the people here today and many others throughout the land, we are taking that first step, they say, in the recovery process is to recognize we have an addiction. That's why we are calling on Governor Murphy to stop any new fossil fuel production and extraction.
That was a Ramapo Lenape man named Owl. Reverend Robin Tanner of the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of the Beacon Summit Church, Chief Dwayne Perry of the Ramapo Lenape Nation, and Matt Smith of Food and Water Watch, New Jersey. Learn more about the demands made by the New Jersey Climate Fasters by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our newly designed and mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on Global Community Radio in Geneva, New York, KHOI in Ames, Iowa, KYAQ in Toledo, Oregon, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.